Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome back to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
We've had an Easter break, and in Brussels, the Brexit machinery has somewhat gone into snooze mode due to that extension to Article 50 agreed by EU leaders on April the 10th. But Brexit is still gouging out British politics at a relentless pace.
As we speak, the Tories have lost over 600 council seats and counting in the local elections. Labour has also lost ground, and the Liberal Democrats have climbed back to their heights during the mid-2000s.
All sides are, of course, blaming Brexit, and for contradictory reasons. We'll try to make sense of the unfolding situation.
And we'll take stock of what the Article 50 extension means for Ireland, for the negotiations and for the upcoming European elections.
We'll also take a first look at the big political showdown around the appointment of the next European Commission president and what we can expect from next week's informal summit of EU leaders in the Romanian city of Sibiu.
But first, Tony, votes are still being counted. The word drubbing has never been so radiantly deployed as today when talking about the Conservative Party in the shires and wards of England.
That's right, Colm. The expected disaster for the Conservative Party has, of course, come to pass. Early this morning, they were taking some comfort from the fact that the losses were not quite as bad as they expected around 9 or 10 o'clock this morning, it being Friday morning, in fact. The numbers look like around 400 seats lost, but that number has climbed as the day has progressed. And currently, as we speak, it's around 4 o'clock Brussels time. And they're breaching 600, so we could be looking at a complete disaster for the Conservative Party. A few things to point out at the beginning of this conversation, which is that it's just England and Northern Ireland that are having the local elections, and it is only in rural and suburban areas. A lot of the big cities are not having their local elections, so that could have an overall bearing on the complexion of this outcome and whether or not the leave factor or the remain factor were entirely decisive. But it does look as though Brexit has been a major theme in these local election results. And obviously, another thing to point out is that the Brexit Party, under the stewardship of the illustrious Nigel Farage, did not take part in these elections, nor did Change UK, the new centrist political movement in the UK. They haven't been taking part in these elections either. So worth bearing that in mind. But anyway, you look at it, it's been a very bad day for Theresa May. And the message seems to be bounding back in her face from Tory voters that they want Brexit simply to be done with. So the whole fact that Brexit hasn't happened on March 29th, as she promised on so many occasions, that has cost the Conservatives dearly. But also, interestingly, the Labour Party have not done very well either.
No room
They've
for
lost
coffin
quite
dancing
a few seats.
There.
No room at all for coffin dancing, as you say. At this part of the electoral cycle, you would expect the opposition party to do well as a springboard for the next general elections. And Labour have lost quite a few seats. Not as bad, obviously, as the Conservative Party. They took the ward of Trafford, which apparently I'm not sure whether that's Old Trafford or New Trafford. Just a footballing reference there, Trafford, anyway, that was being seized upon gleefully, or desperately rather, by Jeremy Corbyn as a victory worth celebrating. But I suppose the whole question from a Brexit point of view is, you know, obviously the Conservatives, we can say with some certainty that they lost on all these seats because voters were just fed up with the lack of Brexit being delivered. The Labour Party, well, it's hard to say whether they
because they weren't strong enough on Remain. Or they weren't strong enough on Leave. You know, that's...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you've got very conflicting responses from some of the party's MPs so far. Jess Phillips, who's a Remain MP, said the party's position on Brexit had failed, meaning, I think, the creative ambiguity that the leadership have tried to adopt, for a long time, in the sense that they're trying to reconcile metropolitan Remain Labour Party voters and the Leave voters of some of the big Northern and Midlands constituencies. Talking about Northern constituencies, Wes Streeting, another MP for Labour, said that the losses in Sunderland and Liverpool demonstrated that looking both ways on Brexit isn't doing Labour any good. Another Remainer, Owen Smith, saying that the fudge was melting under the public's gaze. They lost votes in every direction to the Greens and the Liberal Democrats. But then an interesting and quite a nuanced response from John McDonnell, who's the shadow chancellor, saying that so far the message from the local elections was Brexit sorted, message received, he said on Twitter. Now, he later qualified that by saying, well, he wasn't saying that we have to deliver Brexit. He was saying that we need to sort it out one way or the other, because he was getting quite a bit of flack from some fellow MPs for that apparently pro-Brexit kind of message. But I suppose all of this reinforces both the fragmentation of British politics. We've got 100 new seats taken by independents, the Liberal Democrats doing well, the Greens doing very well too.
Which has been seen elsewhere in Europe, where there's been an anti-establishment vote in Germany, for example, where the AfD did well, the Greens also did well, where in Austria the far right did well there. There was a Green president elected as well. So the Greens seem to be benefiting from people looking around for a non-establishment alternative.
Yeah, that's true. Although I think it would be fair to say that in Germany, the Greens have probably what I might loosely term a more kind of mainstream appeal. But of course, we will be getting into all that stuff in our coverage of the European elections in the next couple of weeks in other podcasts. But again, this I think reflects today the fragmentation, as I said, of British politics, and also the fact that Brexit is really polarizing British politics. So you can have conservative members saying, well, this proves that the public want us to deliver on Brexit, and then Labour Party people saying, well, we've lost support because people want us to remain and to people want us to pursue vigorously the second referendum. Interestingly, the Liberal Democrats have done very well, but not necessarily in strong Remain areas. So that suggests that at the local election level, there hasn't been a surge in support for a second referendum that has been reflected in positive gains for the Liberal Democrats.
It could be just their base returning to them rather than a specific Remain endorsement.
I would agree with that. I think that that's correct in that they are largely recovering the ground that they lost after they went into coalition with David Cameron and the Conservatives.
Then we had the election you were saying at the outset, where the elections weren't happening, the big cities, London being one of them, but Boris Johnson informing his followers on Twitter that he had just voted in the election and was encouraging people to vote Conservative like he had done, which was deleted 60 seconds later because, of course, there was no local election in Boris's constituency.
There you go, the master of the vivid imagination. That's an interesting slapdown from whatever quarter.
From reality.
Very well spotted.
Reality delivers another cruel blow.
Reality bites. Exactly, yeah. So that's really a very brief sort of snapshot of the local elections. The disaster that was expected to befall the Conservatives has happened. And of course, the one way to see this is that, when election comes along, you need the local infrastructure and networks to get volunteers out on the streets canvassing, and if you've had a really disastrous local election, then those volunteers are not necessarily there in huge numbers.
Well, speculation, in terms of the speculation, just looking at the results as they're currently coming in, how might that be viewed from a European perspective? Because presumably a massive UKIP surge might have frightened Theresa May further. You know, we would have had something for her to read from it. But at the moment, if she's taking from it that people just want her to get on with it and cut the deal that's in front of her, it strengthens her hand in a peculiar sort of a way in her dealings with Europe, whilst at the same time hollowing out her support further within her own party.
Well, I suppose the way Europe is looking at the current configuration and mood in Westminster has kind of been fixed for some time, because there is a basic dysfunction which is kind of locked in. You have the referendum result, then you have Theresa May taking over as leader, and then you have progressively the House of Commons getting into gridlock over the withdrawal agreement, the treaty that guides Britain out of the European Union, and what the future relationship should look like as well. And I think that gridlock is still not resolved. There's no real evidence of that being unblocked at the moment. So the room for any major shift as a result of the local elections in terms of the dynamic at Westminster and in terms of the negotiations and the withdrawal agreement, that room is fairly narrow, I would say. And I think that's probably a good opportunity or excuse for us to just to recap on where things are at with the withdrawal agreement and the Article 50 process.
Sure, because we've been off air for about, I suppose, the guts of 3 weeks now. So what's been going on during that time?
Yeah, so the big development, of course, was on April the 10th, the European Council agreed on an extension to Article 50. Theresa May had sought a short extension. This was her second request for an extension, of course, because Britain was due to leave at the end of March. Then the EU agreed to a short extension to the 12th of April if Britain didn't come forward with a clear plan. And at that point, they would have to contest the European elections. Then on the 10th of April, Theresa May went back to Brussels, and there were kind of two camps. One was for a short extension, and the other camp in which I think the Irish government were located was for a long flex extension or a flexible extension up to even as far as March of next year. And on the caveat that if Britain did manage to adopt the withdrawal agreement, then they could leave at that point. But of course, all of this being predicated on Britain contesting the European elections. As it turned out, as people will probably remember, Emmanuel Macron made it his single-handed mission at that summit to resist a long extension. And in the end, they went for a compromise. They kind of split the difference. And so the extension is now until the 31st of October. Now, where does that leave things? Well, we still have the withdrawal agreement, which is the only treaty available for Britain to leave in an orderly fashion. Theresa May, as we know, has tried on three occasions to get that through the House of Commons. She's failed on each occasion, the last time by 149 votes. The DUP have sworn that they will never, ever, ever support the existing withdrawal agreement because of the backstop. So what she has been doing since the summit, or even before the summit, is that she has been trying to negotiate with the Labour Party to get their support for the withdrawal agreement. She can't rely on her own party to get it over the line, or the DUP. So she's been in negotiation. Well, her lieutenants have been in negotiation with their opposite numbers in Labour to try and get something that Labour will sign up to. So therefore, the withdrawal agreement would be ratified in the House of Commons. And according to Theresa May's forlorn hopes that they would do it in time so that they wouldn't have to contest the European elections. But all of that looks fairly fanciful at this stage, because these negotiations are not really going anywhere.
And Labour have a few red lines of their own, one of them being remaining in the customs union and the other being remaining closely aligned, as close as possible, basically, without free movement to the single market, in effect, almost remain without free movement and without influence at the European top table when it comes to drafting laws and decision making?
Yeah, so this has been Labour's position. They want a permanent customs union because they say that that's the best way to protect jobs and trade and the, you know, the supply chains that connect the United Kingdom manufacturing sector with the biggest market on their doorstep, the European Union. But if you are in a customs union with the EU, whether that's a customs union or the customs union, that means you will have to apply the EU's common external tariff on goods, and therefore you, Britain, can not have a fully fledged independent trade policy where they can have trade deals around the world. And that, of course, is the biggest, perhaps last remaining economic argument for Brexit that the Brexiteers have clung to. So you can see how that's really going to be a very difficult thing for the Conservative Party to swallow. But that's what Labour is insisting on. And they're also insisting on a promise that the UK will keep track of EU environmental and social legislation on workers' rights and so on. Now, that's something that Theresa May has largely said that she could live with. But I think, you know, there are so many obstacles to this agreement getting through that one would have to expect that the chances of it are succeeding are fairly slim. So what happens then? Well, Britain will then have to contest the European elections. That will be a major psychological shock for the Conservative Party. Not only are they going to be hammered in those elections again for the second time after the local elections, but also it is just a humiliation, given that the country was supposed to be out of the European Union by the end of March. Now they're still in and they're having to contest European elections. So you could then see Theresa May facing a leadership challenge at the moment, against all of the kind of odds and against the logic of your earlier quip there about Boris Johnson. He is, believe it or not, the bookie's favourite at 3-1 to become the next leader of the Conservative Party. He, of course, commands huge respect among
within the
grassroots.
The Conservative Party.
Within the Conservative Party, but he is loathed in equal measure outside the Conservative Party.
And in some quarters within the Conservative Party.
And absolutely within the Conservative Party in their moderate wing. But this, of course, is having a bearing on these negotiations at party level, because the Conservatives appear to want to have an agreement between the two parties as such, whereas the Labour Party would prefer to have these ideas fully realised through the political declaration, which of course accompanies the withdrawal agreement and is non-binding. But if you are going to have a permanent customs union, or Britain being in the customs union, then you can stitch that into the joint political declaration, and I think that would be something Labour would prefer, because if it's only an agreement between the two parties, they would worry that if Boris Johnson, for example, takes over, then he would tear up that particular agreement and all bets would be off. So then, you know, if you do have a scenario of Boris Johnson being leader of the Conservative Party, now he's an avowed leaver, and as is you know, repeatedly on the record of saying that no deal would not be much of a problem. What does he do as leader? Does he say, right, either let's go for no deal, or he could say, well, it wouldn't be my first choice, so we're going to go back to the EU to get them to ditch the backstop, etc., etc.
Right.
That's obviously not going to happen. So then that goes into the sand, and then what happens then? You probably have a general election, and we're back to we're back
possibly
to square one.
Today, yeah.
Poll numbers, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I mean, I suppose that the
except Boris
the
Johnson at that point,
is,
or the Tory Party is fighting the Brexit Party as well.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And the Brexit Party are expected to do very well in the European elections coming up. They're at around 28-30% ahead of the other two parties, Labour and the Conservatives. So So if you, when you look at it, I think the important point to make is that this shortish extension to the end of October is really not that long at all. And a lot of it is already being eaten up by things like the local elections, the talk of a leadership contest, talk of Boris Johnson taking over. Of course, the EU is going to be preoccupied by its own problem of having to go through the European elections and
deal with the aftermath.
A new president of, the aftermath being the appointment of a new European Commission president. Then into the autumn, you've got party conferences happening from the end of September onwards. So there's not really an awful lot of time between now and the 31st of October to get into any real territory where you can, like, once and for all resolve this problem.
And is it all in deep freeze in Brussels at the moment? Are people heaving a sigh of relief saying, thank God we don't have to deal with that? Or is the wargaming continuing behind the scenes as to the forward planning towards the October deadline and the various scenarios that might arise? Is all that homework by and large done on the Brussels side, or is it continually grinding away in the background?
Well, I would say, first of all, that there has been a noticeable break, and you know, people have gone off on holidays. The political class in the UK have gone off on holidays as well. They're having their local elections, obviously, this week. So there is a big sense of people just taking a breather, I think, you know, from the exhaustion of Brexit, which has been relentless, as we know, you know, for the past year and a half. So there is that sense of people just letting the UK get on with it. And I think it was the extension was deliberate in that sense as well, that Britain, that Europe does have other priorities and things it wants to get on with. But you're right to say that there are immediate challenges and issues. One, of course, being the European elections and what that is going to look like in terms of the composition of the new European Parliament. It's widely expected that far-right, nationalist, anti-immigrant parties are going to do well in big populous countries like Italy, France, Spain, for example, Poland. So the big question there, and of course we get into this in more detail in future podcasts, the big question there is how big will their combined weight in the European Parliament.
And whether they'll work together, because they're spread across several different groups. The issue of Russia divides quite a lot of those far-right parties. So they have their differences, but they are united in terms of trying to curb the power of Brussels and the liberalising pro-immigration influence of Brussels as they see it. At the very least, that binds them in common.
Yeah, I mean, they do have certain themes in common, and Matteo Salvini, the leader of the Lega party, the far-right anti-immigrant party in Italy, who is the interior minister there, they're in government with the Five-Star Movement, of course. He has been trying to cajole other right-wing parties in Europe to form a big alliance, a big bloc in the European Parliament that would really disrupt things. Now, he's made several overtures on that front, most recently with Viktor Orban. He, in Hungary, the far-right leader there, the populist leader, if you like, in Hungary, who has been notoriously falling out with the European People's Party, the centre-right group that Fine Gael is a member of, because of... he's suspended from that at the moment. They haven't been kicked out entirely, but they've been suspended. So those efforts by Salvini are ongoing, but I have to say that they haven't entirely been successful, and we'll just see in the next few weeks what happens with those efforts, whether or not he can form this new alliance that could really, you know, disrupt and eat away at the process of the European Parliament and the European machinery from within. The other interesting dilemma, which has a Brexit flavour, is what impact would the British participating in the European elections have on the composition of the Parliament? Now, initially, when this extension was agreed, it looked like Labour was going to be the big winner of the European elections, and that would boost the Socialist and Democrats bloc in the European Parliament, and that could have an outcome on things like the appointment of the next European Commission president or even the council. More immediately, the complexion of the next parliament will govern who gets positions in the committees, the all-important committees in the European Parliament, who gets to be rapporteur, who gets to be the head of the committees. All of those are big issues which can be complicated if there is a sudden influx of British MEPs who were not expected to be there.
Well, so, there was even pressure on the Social Democrat or Labour Party MEP from the UK, from the London region, Claude Moraes, under the lifetime of the present session of the Parliament, felt that he was being marginalised and there was active pressure on him to stand aside from the role that he had because he wouldn't be there to see through the consequences of it, or so they thought. So there is a reluctance among some MEPs to have British MEPs in influential positions if they're not going to be around for the full duration.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's a bit of a worry. I mean, at sort of state level, the United Kingdom as a state, as a continuing member of the European Union, is bound by the principle of sincere cooperation. So there has been quite a bit of pressure on the UK from the other EU leaders. And also this has been discussed internally at EU level that the risks of a longer extension could amount to Britain using its continued membership to its own advantage when it isn't a member. So, for example, you know, in terms of the budget or in terms of the EU's trade policy. So there have been fairly blunt warnings that if Britain wants an extension, it has to play by the rules, it has to behave itself. It can't be trying to win an advantage. I mean, there have been, as far as I'm aware, there have been a number of occasions where the UK has gone off and had discussions with Switzerland over a future trade agreement and didn't tell the EU it was doing it. And there were quite a few noses out of joint over that. So there is a suspicion that Britain will try to seek advantage in this extension, that it would cash in once it leaves. But of course, the UK have said that they will abide by this principle of sincere cooperation. But the point I'm making is that that principle does not extend to MEPs. You know, they can pretty much do what they like. So the other big question, of course, then, which we can get on to now, is the once the elections happen, the European elections happen, then, of course, the normal procedure is that the European Union, the heads of government, appoint the next commission of the European Commission.
So, in other words,
president of the Commission.
Under the current system, the theory being that the group of MEPs, the largest party in Parliament, its Spitzenkandidat, the top candidate, their nominee for European Commission president, goes forward to be ratified, and then that's sent back, or it goes forward to be approved and it's ratified by the Parliament. Is that necessarily what's going to happen? Because there has been talk that that might not be followed. But give us your analysis.
Yeah, so this Spitzenkandidat idea is a new one, and it was first put into practice in the 2014 elections, and it is on the cards again this time around because the main political groups, the EPP on the centre-right, the Socialists and Democrats in the centre-left, the Liberals, ALDE as they're called, and the Greens have all nominated a lead candidate, or Spitzenkandidat as the German would have it. But of course, it is not by any means a serene operation, because there are many people who question whether it is actually legal under the EU treaties that the European Parliament should be able to do that. I mean, the European Council, when it's appointing the next Commission President, has to take account of the view of the Parliament. But does that go as far as to give the Parliament a carte blanche to say, well, this is the group that got most votes, so therefore the candidate from that group automatically becomes the Commission President? People say that is a bit of a power grab. Now, back in 2014, you'll recall that Jean-Claude Juncker became the nominee for the EPP, the European People's Party, at a big convention in Dublin, no less. And initially, Angela Merkel was not entirely convinced of that methodology for the reasons I've just outlined. But then when there was a big backlash when she hinted that she wasn't going to follow up this lead candidate idea. There was a backlash in the German press saying that this was an affront to democracy because this lead candidate did have a democratic mandate through the European elections. So she kind of changed her mind. And eventually Jean-Claude Juncker did become the commission president. He, of course, was voted against by David Cameron, you might remember, in the actual council vote.
There was a black ops campaign through the British media run about his lunchtime beverage habits and many other things.
Yeah, and also the fact that his father, I think, had been a member at one point of the Wehrmacht during the Second World War. So all of that stuff was kind of dragged in. Ironically enough, I think Jean-Claude Juncker has probably been something of a friend to Theresa May during the travails of the Brexit negotiations. But the question, of course, now is like, is this Spitzenkandidat idea going to happen again? Is there resistance to it? And you'd have to say there is resistance to it, although the political groups have gone through the motions. The EPP have appointed Manfred Weber as their lead candidate, but he is not universally adored, you'd have to say, even though all EPP heads of government formally adopted him at their Congress in Helsinki before Christmas. But, you know, he's never had ministerial office. He's been an MEP for most of his political career. He is kind of tarnished by the whole handling of
the Orban thing.
Viktor Orban and Fidesz, yeah, that whole question of whether it's proper for them to be members of the EPP at all because of their anti-immigrant far-right rhetoric. So there is a big question over whether he will be ditched at the last minute by the EPP or by the heads of government in favour of some other candidate. Now, that is all going to be extremely political. The EPP insiders I've spoken to have sworn blind that he is the candidate. He will not be thrown under a bus because, of course, there is the rumour that perhaps Michel Barnier, who's also in the EPP family, that he might get the
nod. It is a remarkably stubborn rumour.
It is, yeah, and it's not going away, as you say, and of course there is a lot of speculation about what Emmanuel Macron will do. I mean, France, as a European Council member, has quite some considerable weight in this matter. He, of course, has yet to formally align himself with the Liberal group in the European Parliament. So the question there is, will he throw his weight behind Guy Verhofstadt, who is the Liberal candidate, or perhaps even Margrethe Vestager, the highly polished and very high-profile commissioner for competition. We know her very well in Ireland, of course, because of the Apple case. And she would be regarded as a very capable candidate for commission president. But will she get the nod from France? So the whole question of how you appoint the next head of the European Commission, the next president of the Commission, is kind of a Rubik's Cube of north, south, east, west, left, right, male, female. All of those factors have to be put into the mix, and it's a highly political process. And you can't say with any certainty that the Spitzenkandidat process will definitively preempt and define how that all plays out.
It sounds like the intrigues of a Renaissance-era city-state somewhere in Italy.
Without the stabbing. Well, maybe with the stabbings.
It's not over yet. Off to Romania, Sibiu, next week. Is that a Brexit-free zone, or are people going to take a deep breath and say, we have other things on the table here that we need to get dealt with? Every summit can't be a Brexit summit. What way is it going to go?
Yeah, well, the background to this summit next week, now it is an informal summit, and interestingly, the idea of a summit of this nature was initially dreamt up in the very early days of Brexit. The EU felt that, okay, Britain's going to be leaving on the 29th of March 2019, we want to show that the European Union is not simply crippled or obsessed by Brexit, by the negotiations. We want to have a gathering where we will confidently show citizens that we've moved beyond Brexit. We have a strategic vision for the future of European citizens, of the European Union and so on. So they picked a date in May. I think Jean-Claude Juncker originally wanted it to be the day after the 29th of March, which probably wasn't going to be a great idea. So they picked a day shortly after Brexit Day. It turns out to be next week in the Romanian city of Sibiu. They, of course, have the rotating presidency of the European Union at the moment. Now, initially, they were planning to have a sort of strategic discussion on the priorities of the European Union over the next 5 years. But because Brexit hasn't happened and the Brits haven't gone away, because of the European elections, like a lot of the sort of big strategic stuff would be fairly sensitive from a European election point of view. So it turns out that the meeting in Sibiu next week is not quite going to be the fireworks that people may have expected. There will be a declaration of the EU's outlook on the future. There will be four main themes. One will be the question of external and internal security. So that'll be all about migration and the external borders being secured. There will be a discussion on the so-called fairness and green agenda. Then there'll be a discussion on the whole question of Europe's place in the world, wedged as it is between China and Russia and on the one hand and the US on the other. And this is all about how Europe should become a bit more self-assertive, that it's not simply being kicked around by Trump or undermined or played by China in the whole question of technology
or in Africa.
Or in Africa as well, given China's investments there. So they're going to be discussing these big things. There will be a declaration, but it will not be a sort of full-blooded European Union leader manifesto. It will be a little bit more muted.
All right, Tony, that's it. The comeback edition.
Yeah, good to be back.
Good to have you back.
After the break. It is going to be a busy week, even though Brexit is in this rather turgid phase in Brussels, in Westminster. There are going to be big developments over the next few weeks with the European elections and then with the appointment of the new commission. And then in the autumn, of course, there's the new president of the European Council taking over from Donald Tusk. There's going to be a new head of the ECB. So, yeah, busy agenda, Brexit or otherwise.
Good stuff. Well, that's it from me, Colm O'Mungain, RTE's Deputy Foreign Editor in Dublin.
And from me, Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe Editor in Brussels. Thanks for listening.